The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra, the Champions League, and more proof, if it were needed, that the Premier League is the greatest league in the world as all four English sides make it through to the knockout stages, mainly at the expense of Italians. Is Paolo okay? We'll find out. Also, Real Madrid claps at home to Cesca, Thomas Müller goes full Street Fighter 2, and PSG look quite good. Elsewhere, we'll look ahead to the Premier League games, answer your questions, and deal with a very grumpy panel after I force them to come in early again. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Lars Sivertsen, nice to see you.
Hi, Max.
Paolo Bandini, are you okay?
I'm just about holding up. Less okay for the 8 a.m. start than the results, to be honest.
Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Are you happy?
I'm all right.
Okay.
I'm here.
Yeah. Got some WhatsApps last night saying, I'm never doing an early pod again.
Yeah, I just want to stress to the listeners who are saying, 8 o'clock, that's not that early. I've been up since 5:15.
Okay.
Because I had work to do before the podcast.
Do you want a medal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Have you got one?
No. Anyway, let's start with the football. Then second successive season, all English sides through to the last 16. Group B, Barca 1, Spurs 1, Inter 1, PSV 1. So Barca win the group. Spurs are through. Inter drop into the Europa League. Paolo, that was a very tense evening as a plastic Spurs fan.
Yeah, it was a tense evening. I mean, it was a really odd evening, and they always are when you've got these sort of teams not quite knowing whether their destiny is in their own hands. My focus was slightly more on what was happening at San Siro, and it was really bizarre to me the way Inter reacted after getting themselves level at 1-1. And you'd think at that point, of course, Tottenham were losing, but you still think, well, yeah, but they're losing by one goal, and maybe if they score, that's going to really change things. But Inter just sort of really, they celebrated that goal that they were through. They took their foot off the pedal again for the next few minutes. They'd been absolutely, having not started the game especially well, although they could have gone ahead with Ivan Perisic's header, which came back off the post. They hadn't played particularly well in the first half. In the second half, they'd come out like, okay, you know, we're about to go to the Champions League. We'll give it everything. And then Icardi scores, and yeah, that's the moment to try and get a second goal, and they didn't. They sort of eased off again, and then it was only when the crowd reacted quite audibly to Tottenham equalising that suddenly they had this sort of last panic at the very end. And yeah, it was a very odd, just a very odd sort of flow to the game, which was so clearly influenced by events that were going on elsewhere. And of course, to a certain extent, it was out of Inter's hands, because if Tottenham had won, then it wouldn't have mattered what they did. But given the way things panned out with hindsight, and even, I say with hindsight, even at the time, it was sort of odd to watch, and to me very strange approach. They did let themselves, I think, let themselves be affected by the occasion and not keep their focus where it should have been.
Lars, isn't this when football's at its best? You know, it's like the last day of the season when fans have, well, in the old days, transistor radios, and now, you know, Twitter in front of them, and they're wondering what's going on at different places, and coaches are giving messages to the players, and the players on one side know what's happening, but they haven't told, you know, the left winger yet what's happening. I just loved it.
It's great fun. I think it's interesting that it was a sort of a Spurs versus Inter thing, because I guess it's fair to say they're both teams that have a sort of history and a legacy of messing things up in a big way.
Is Serie A, is there, you know, to be Inter-y? Is that such a thing?
Well, there is, you know, it's not entry, but there is an equivalent, which is actually Inter's, you know, the club anthem makes reference to Pazza Inter, crazy Inter. Pazza Inter is a thing that Inter sort of don't deliver in certain moments, or if they do it in the most ludicrous way possible, is very much as much a part of the discourse, I would say, as being Spursy as in England.
Which is why, I mean, I at the live show, I suggested the most likely outcome would be that both teams would mess up. And that's kind of what happened in a way. Like, none of them managed to get a win, which was always the likely outcome in a strange way. But I think it's such a huge thing for Spurs. Because when you have this culture of Spursing it up, of being Spursy, like, the only way you can really change that is by not messing up, is by building positive experiences. It reminds me of when you hear ex-England players talk about the weight of expectation and all of this. I think it was Gary Neville who wrote once in a column that when playing for England, when things start going well, you're not immediately thinking, how do I fix this? You're thinking, oh God, it's happening again. You know, what sort of route are the papers going to make me look like tomorrow? anymore. All this sort of nonsense, you're not focusing on just fixing the problems that are ahead of you. And that's the kind of thing that happens when you have this legacy bearing down on you. And the only thing you can really change that is by having these positive experiences. And the way that, say, Liverpool at Anfield, like, these players might not have been involved in a lot of great sort of last grasp winners, but they know there's a history of that at Anfield, Liverpool, so they feel like we can do this because that's the way it is, in the way that England players maybe feel they can't do it because that's the way it's always been. Now for Spurs, having a night like this when they're up against it, I don't think anyone were expecting them to win, even if Barcelona had a slightly weaker lineup. It's a huge deal for the club and in terms of turning around the culture there.
I slightly disagree with your last point, Lars. I saw that lineup for Barcelona and thought, if this is a Tottenham team that talks about itself and aspires to be genuinely a top club in England and a top club in Europe, why should you not be a team that's fielding some real kids there? I mean, I know they had Dembele and Coutinho, but some of that team was really guys with no experience at all starting for Barcelona. But that's, I don't want to sort of get sort of completely bogged down in that. I still think your broader point I agree with, and I think that to me there was a sort of tangible difference in the approaches, and there's a maturity issue here of Inter and Tottenham, two teams with this reputation, on this final day. I thought Tottenham did attack that game and play that game with a courage and a conviction that was sort of visibly striking, which Inter didn't. And I think that's sort of the point you're making more broadly is that.
I obviously, there's no arguing with the rotated Barcelona squad, but you're also taking... Tottenham are going to the Camp Nou with a midfield of Harry Winks and Moses Sissoko, and with, you know, Kyle Walker-Peters on the field. You know, it's not... If you say ahead of time Tottenham will have that lineup away to Barcelona and get a result, that is also
I just think away to Barcelona sort of... I don't know... It's not, again, it's not sort of to diminish the approach, which I thought was brilliant, to diminish the fact they played good football. It's just this idea that because they're Barcelona, they're automatically amazing, is to me a little bit odd when some of these guys... I mean, we're not talking about, you know, someone... We're not talking about the Dembélés and the Coutinhos, who are obviously brilliant players. And Dembélé is just so wonderful to watch when he's running like that. But the defence, these were guys who literally... I think there was one debut in there, wasn't there? You know, they are still footballers. They're not sort of, because they're wearing a Barcelona shirt, automatically charged up with some superpower. They're still guys who are learning the game at this level. And I think, I don't know. I think some of the sort of the post-match conversation, even how Harry Kane was saying, I think, oh, you know, we're trying to win this whole tournament. And again, it's a long tournament. They may well play like it later in the tournament. I don't think drawing with this Barcelona team tells me you're ready to win the tournament.
Well, that I would agree with, but Barcelona are still bringing out arguably the best player in history off the bench when it's sure. At a point in time where one goal will basically kill it. So it's not like they've not beaten Barca B entirely. They've beaten some of Barca B, I guess. But you've still got Rakitic and Arthur in midfield. I don't agree that it was a completely scratch, you know, Barcelona team.
You're right, Beth.
Yeah, I could have had an extra 20 minutes in bed if I'd known this.
Well, I've got the yogurt pot and I just wondered. But listen, I thought, I totally take your point, Paolo, about, you know, this myth of Barcelona. And, you know, you look at Real Madrid as well. There's a sort of myth of going to those places and thinking, well, it's just an impossibility. We're up against 11 superheroes.
On the night when Cisco Mosco went to Real Madrid and spanked them.
Exactly. But by the same token, Tottenham did play very well, Barry. And really... attacked well. Pochettino made good changes at the right times. Those players, Lamella and Moura, both had an impact as well.
Yeah, I thought Tottenham could have won comfortably, probably should have won comfortably, and weirdly could have also lost comfortably because Philippe Coutinho hit the post, the foot of the post at either end with two shots you'd expect him to score with, or, you know, that could have gone in off the post. But Spurs had chance after chance after chance, and just errant finishing did for them, really. I'm kind of inclined to agree with Paolo. I had a feeling they would get through. I had a feeling they would get through from even after the three games. And, you know, Barcelona were always likely to field an understrength team, but you play what's in front of you, and Spurs played them very, very well. But it would have been a shame if they hadn't gone through and got that late equaliser, because... That would have been tragic, considering how well they played.
Carl Walker-Peters tweeted, so much to learn from that game. I mean, presumably, the first thing to learn is to not slip when Dembele's that close to you. I mean, it would have almost, I was trying to think, it would have almost been better if he just played a soft back pass and Dembele had run through and scored. But the fact that he had a chance to kind of catch up and then fall over again, and then Harry Winks sort of turned into a cartoon and just like flew across the box and Dembele went, I'll just put it in now. Danny Rose.
I thought Walker Peters did well to recover from that because it happened so early in the game. It could have absolutely destroyed him and ruined, you know, he could have gone on to have a nightmare. So hats off to him for that.
It would have been great if Danny Rose had scored what was a lovely move at the end. But he had a very good game. The best game I've seen him play for a long time, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, across the pitch, lots of good performances. And this is sort of the thing that's unquestionable in all this. Pochettino has done such a good job of keeping faith in certain players. And actually, I think Danny Rose spoke about that after the game with the reference to Walker Peters. He's someone who won't sort of suddenly turn his back on a player just because they make a mistake like that. He'll keep developing them. He'll keep sort of, once you've got his faith, once he believes in you, he'll keep showing it to you. And I think Pochettino has shown that over and over with this squad, and it's why you do see. Okay, there's a lot of sort of talk about, Tottenham need to spend it in January. And look, there's no sort of question when you get into the numbers, when you can compare and contrast with, for instance, Liverpool, who went through last night, and how they've spent in recent years. Tottenham have been exceptionally effective on a tight budget, really. And I think that is ultimately down to Pochettino being able to continually get not just his first 11, but the players who aren't always in the team to still be part of things, to still have that buy-in, to still produce performances when he needs them.
And you say, Lars, about, you know, that sort of Liverpool late goal thing. Spurs in the last three games, you know, 1-0 down to PSV, scored two late goals. Kept on going against Inter, scored late here as well. So that belief is they could win it.
Well, I mean, they're in it still, so theoretically they could win it.
That's my point.
Yeah.
Group C, PSG win the group. Liverpool are through.
Staying in.
Napoli drop into Europa League. Are you all right, Paolo?
Yeah, I don't know why people think I won't be all right when teams that I don't support don't make it through in a competition. I will say, and I think it bears repeating with both of these groups, that the margins were ridiculously fine. I mean, Tottenham go through by virtue of away goals in the head-to-head. Liverpool go through, actually, the head-to-head can't even separate them in Napoli, so it goes on to, I think, goals scored. And some of the things that happened in this group that could have changed that, even Napoli's margin of victory at home to Red Star, they conceded a late goal, and if they hadn't conceded that goal, then of course in that situation this last game might play out differently. But that's the margins we're talking about. I would say, despite the fact that the margins were sort of identically close in both groups, the contrast between how impressed I was with the performance and who I sort of feel worse for, not for myself, I'm fine, but for worse for, is I do feel much worse for Napoli than for Inter. I think Napoli, through this group stage, played four really good games, an okay game away to Red Star, and this was the one game they didn't get right, and it's the only one they lost and they haven't gone through. And I think that, again, you can talk about the goal they conceded late against Red Star, even in victory. The goal they conceded away to PSG, when they were so good away to PSG and should have won. And Angel Di Maria comes off with this wonder goal at the end. And it's just that thing, that reminder, unfortunately, for a club like Napoli, who are, sorry to bore on about budgets, but budget-wise, just not in the same ballpark as some of these other clubs, that PSG you'd look at and go, who's the sort of third or fourth player in that team who you'd want taking a pot shot from 30 yards at the end? Oh, it's Angel Di Maria still. Okay, fine, you can do it. That the group has been incredibly tough for Napoli. I think they would have made it through easily in most groups in this tournament. I think Carlo Ancelotti's getting picked on them playing great football. This was the one game in the group where I didn't think they played very well. I thought Liverpool absolutely bossed them at Anfield. It still could have pinched at the end with that Milik chance. But yeah, Liverpool were comfortably the better side on the night.
You mentioned that chance at the end, and it was a good save, Barry, from Alisson, but the last 2 days it's become sort of Gordon Banks, you know, while doing a scorpion kick at the same time, the greatest save in the history of football.
No, it was far from it. I mean, it gets extra points because it was very late in the game, and would have, if he hadn't made the save, Liverpool would have gone out of the competition, and that's why he's getting so much credit. I mean, I saw someone on Twitter say that short of him being a hologram, he couldn't conceivably have not saved it. I think that's also a bit harsh. But yeah, it was an important save. And Alisson is undeniably a very, very good goalkeeper who has helped Liverpool come on in leaps and bounds from last season. He's such an improvement on what they had. And, you know, when we sort of think that more or less the reason they didn't win the Champions League final is because their goalkeeper had an absolute calamitous performance, this is in stark contrast. But yeah, people are going ridiculously overboard about it. I think the reason is because he made the save so late in the game.
Are you suggesting Loris Karius is a hologram?
Possibly.
Liverpool scored more goals against Alisson in two games last year versus Roma than the entire Premier League has managed to in half a season. That's a good stat.
Good stat. You do, on the subject of Napoli being slightly unfortunate overall, I mean, you do wonder how the game would have panned out if Van Dijk had been sent off.
So
it's worth asking.
It was like who got sent off for Spurs? Vertonghen.
Yeah.
It was a similar one, wasn't it? Where you get the ball and then you follow through. I didn't think it was as bad as Vertonghen's.
Well, the thing that astonished me was just the conversation that happened on BT Sport with this one, where they seemed to be genuinely sort of discussing whether he should have even been shown a card at all, which to me is, I mean, his studs were up. And this whole sort of got the ball thing is such a red herring sometimes. If you go studs up into someone's shin, you can take the ball first. It's still a dangerous tackle. It just is.
But if you take the ball on the ground, I'm doing some football now, but, you know, if you take the ball on the ground as you slide through, your sort of natural... It's slightly natural to for your leg to come up a bit,
and I think that I'm okay for having a conversation here about which card he gets. It was the fact that the tone of the conversation seemed to be, oh, was that even a foul because he got the ball first, and that just like it's this sort of locked in mentality some people seem to have that as soon as you touch the ball everything's okay, which isn't true.
Well, that's just people not knowing the rules, and it's a surprisingly high number of people who don't.
Am I in that?
No, I don't know. Well, but it. You know, the game of association football is played according to a set of rules, and one of those rules states
laws,
that...
Laws, actually.
Oh, very good. Thanks. Anyway, one of those laws...
Thank you.
He was just really, in a really posh way, trying to say your name, Lars.
Lars.
I haven't seen you look this happy in months.
Well, you're for the about benefit, to embark on a pedantic rant. Get it right.
For the benefit of the listener, Barry's actually rocking in his chair now in just happiness. But one of those laws state that a tackle or challenge that endangers the safety of an opponent or uses excessive force or brutality must be sanctioned as serious foul play. Any player who lunges at an opponent in challenging further ball from the front, from the side, or from behind, using one or both legs with excessive force or endangers the safety of an opponent, is guilty of serious foul play, which is a red card. Now, you can't look at that tackle and say that he's not endangering the opponent. Like, you can very easily break an ankle the way he goes in there. It is a red card, according to the rules, whether he gets the ball or not. Because, surprisingly, I've looked very hard at this, there is not a caveat here that says, unless you get the ball first. You, that just isn't in there.
You should, Lars,
this
do,
law.
You should do an audiobook of the laws of football. Lars Laws. I would download. You get one download, at least. Okay, so who won the Koulibaly v Van Dijk contest, or was that just a made-up thing because there were two tall centre-backs happening to be on the same pitch at the same time?
I think it's mostly a made-up thing, but I thought that, both of them had good games. I think Koulibaly was probably more visible because Napoli were on the back foot so much, and so you saw more of him, but I thought he had several... notable interventions over the course of the first half in particular.
Apart from, I guess, the goal where Salah did him, and it was glorious from Salah, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, Salah's a brilliant player, and it's great to see him starting to show it again after a slightly slow start to the season.
I think Barney made a good point that actually this is Salah's first goal against anybody good. You know, he'd been on a very good run of scoring in a sort of Lukaku style, you know, against your, insert a Premier League team that you want to insult now, Barry, you know, a sort of Watford or a, you know, Cardiff. He's been scoring against those type of teams, even if he hasn't scored against those two teams. But you take my point.
Yeah. I thought in the battle of the goalkeepers, actually, Alisson's save at the end overshadowed a remarkable performance from David Ospina, who basically turned into an octopus for the evening. You know, the goal went through his legs, but apart from that, he made some terrific saves and, you know, almost single-handedly kept Liverpool at bay. So that must be just absolutely devastating to have a performance that good and still go out of the competition.
Did anyone see the Napoli fan crying after 50 minutes?
Yeah.
That was marvellous, wasn't it? It's a really defeatist fan. Bournemouth, Watford, Fulham, Cardiff, Huddersfield, Southampton, Brighton and West Ham. They're the teams that Salah had scored against up until scoring against a good team.
I thought it was an even better night for England in the Champions League than I'd realised when you started listing that.
Yes, they're all through to the knockout stages. PSG won 4-1 at Red Star. And Cavani scored a lovely goal after a lovely run from Mbappe. Neymar amazingly composed for the second sort of feigned to shoot about 100 times until every single Red Star player had fallen over. Marquinhos and Mbappe rounded it off. I know, Barry, they're going to go out shambolically at some point. But when they're good, I know it was just Red Star, but Red Star had you know, beaten Liverpool at home. PSG looked like, when it clicks, that they really could do something.
Yeah, but they won't. I mean, look, I've had my PSG time. You know, I was utterly vindicated when people were laughing and pointing at me when they battered Barcelona in the first leg of the quarterfinals,
something was it? Like
and then Barcelona came back to beat them. So, you know, that was pretty much as low as they can go. They seem to have got some sort of backbone. My concern would be that the quality of opposition they play every week is so poor. Like, they don't have any competitors in Ligue 1. At least in the Premier League, we have six teams who can give each other a game. And, you know, but that just doesn't seem to happen in Ligue 1. I say that, but they have drawn their past two games. So
I know, you know, we like to perpetuate these things. I would watch out for PSG this year. I think that they are better tangibly than they have been in the last couple of years.
But do we not perpetuate these things because these things always happen?
Right, until they don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. It was the same at the beginning when with both City and Chelsea, when they had a lot more money and initially they didn't win right away and it was easy to sort of poke a bit of fun. I think Mbappe is really becoming more of a difference maker again this season. He wasn't good last year. I think Thomas Tuchel is getting a hold of this team. I think they played better towards the end of this group than they did at the beginning of it. That's all I'm saying.
Does anyone think Thomas Tuchel looks a bit like a Bond villain? He's got a sort of evil look about him. In that kind of nerdy evil. You know, they're the most evil, aren't they?
Yeah, well, sort of latter-day Bond villains are... They don't look particularly villainous. They?
No.
They're funny, PSG, because they are... I still maintain that this team is a ridiculous construct in a number of ways. But because of their front line, they are a team who can feasibly score several goals against any opponent on the planet. And even if you do have a centre-half playing in midfield because you haven't been able to sign a defensive midfielder because your club's run in quite a stupid manner, you're still going to have a good chance at winning, I think, against anyone there. So I guess I'm not going to give up on the notion that they're a silly team, but you're still probably right, Paolo. I think that they still might actually go quite far.
All right, that'll do for part one. In part two, we will do the rest of the Champions League games. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. On the 22nd of January, Barry and Lars, we're going to Dublin. Woo-hoo. Without Paolo.
Oh.
Sorry about that. Barney's coming instead. We're doing a live show. It'll be great. It may not be, but hopefully it will be.
It won't be that great because, I don't know, travelling with Barney is an ordeal.
Well, Barney becomes dad.
He just never stops complaining.
He's
asking silly questions that no one knows the answers to about logistics and.
True. He's sort of got a sort of nervous energy, but in a sort of dad way, you know, I think.
I would have thought I'm more in the role of dad and he's annoying child asking annoying questions.
You're sort of deaf.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
You're deaf grandpa.
I'll bring my ear trumpet then.
Group F, Man City 2, Hoffenheim 1, Shakhtar 1, Lyon 1. So Shakhtar could have gone through if they'd beaten Lyon, but they didn't. City win the group, Lyon are through. Five successive draws for them, but they were unbeaten in the group. Would have been harsh on Lyon not to go through, having not lost to Manchester City and beaten them at the Etihad. Leroy Sané's free kick, Lars.
Yeah.
That was wonderful, wasn't it?
It was excellent. It was on first viewing, you think the goalkeeper should do better, but then you watch it again and you realise it's kind of moving away from him and it's actually quite tricky to get to. And yeah, he just smashed it. Lovely. Great stuff.
It's one of those where you watch it and you... most things you can work out technically how to do it and maybe go and practice it yourself in your bedroom. But that, if you had a sort of 30-yard bedroom, but that was just...
What are they paying you, Matt?
I just thought it was such a beautiful free kick.
He said himself after the game that he wasn't sure whether to have a go or not because he thought it might be too far out and that it was quite lucky. I think he's being a little modest.
Yeah. He also got the other one as well. He was also involved in that really fun 3-on-1 where somehow Man City were clean through...
3 players on the keeper.
Yeah, but they were clean through 10 yards outside their own penalty area. That's the thing that I couldn't understand.
Well, I think that was because Hoffenheim, for the last half hour, more or less, were playing with... one goalkeeper, one defender, and 9 men forward. So,
I thoroughly recommend it. Phil Foden had a great volley as well. Pep said he was incredible. Lars, why are you laughing at that? He's the future of English football.
I mean, in the season when we're having Jadon Sancho doing what he's doing in Germany, you look at Phil Foden, and I understand why he wants to stay at Man City. You know, being coached by Pep and all this, it's great place to be, and I'm sure he will be part of this team at some point, but he should still be playing more football, surely. Like Pep is saying,
he's only 18.
Oh, he's incredible. He should be playing more then, right?
How old Sancho?
18, I think.
Is he 18 as well?
Yeah, but if you look at how incredible Foden has to be all the time to earn a place in that team, it's not going to happen anytime soon, you would think. It may happen in the future. And I'd agree with Lars. He needs to be playing football somewhere else.
Raheem Sterling had a great chance to score. He was the Premier League Player of the Month, which, you know, after probably... I mean, I don't know if it's a tumultuous week for him. A lot of talk about him. I imagine he just turned his social media off, didn't he? But deserves the Premier League Player of the Month. So well done to him. Shakhtar won. Oh, quickly... the penalty for Hoffenheim, should Laporte get sent off there? Because he's not really going for the ball, is he? And if he's not going for the ball, it is a red card.
I feel like I should defer to Lars.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not wrong. It felt for me more of a tussle on first viewing than a sort of cynical drag back, but you're probably right there, actually.
You mean you don't know?
I'm not quite sure. I mean... it becomes a question, like you say, whether he's going from the ball or not.
But there was this, you know, they have sort of addressed this double, or sometimes for some reason they call it triple jeopardy situation, where if a keeper commits a foul as a last man, they don't go off. Mm. But for a defender...
It's still a question of whether he's going for the ball or not. Mm. And whether that was a tussle for the ball or just a cynical tug of the shoulder. Yeah, that's the question of how you want to define it.
Producer Jonathan has made a fatal mistake by writing... don't make Lars a thing, please.
This bit is not staying in anyway. So,
Shakhtar 1, Lyon 1. It looked about minus a million degrees. I thought it's not fair to play
perfectly
football.
Normal weather for football, Max. I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, it was like it was horizontal snow. I just don't think it's fair to play a game in that sort of condition.
I just think it's sad that, to my knowledge, none of the goal scorers did what the mighty Alex Tetti once did for Rosenborg, which was he scored a goal and then he ran off and celebrated by making a snow angel, which is what you should do under those conditions.
And I can't remember, some lower league footballer that when there was sort of a mound of snow that had been swept off, literally just jumped head first into the snow mound. It was a lovely goal by Nabil Fekir. That means Lyon go through, and they deserve to go through, as I said, because of how they've done in this group.
Yeah, it's actually been like a wildly entertaining group, I think. I think there's been a lot of really fun group stage football this year. I just wanted to, on that note, just a quick shout out for Hoffenheim. He scored 11 goals in this group stage and didn't win a single game. I mean, that's something going. You're averaging nearly 2 goals a game and you didn't manage to win one of them.
Group H, Valencia 2, Manchester United 1, Young Boys 2, Juve 1. So Juve win the group. United could have won the group. Who would like to talk about Phil Jones' own goal?
Oh, God. It was hilarious.
It was lovely, wasn't it? Just so calm.
I don't know. It's hard to do with justice, really. Carlos Soler's through ball, keeper's comes out to get it, and Phil Jones, for whatever reason, I don't know what he was thinking, just, you know, slides in and slots it past him and into his own net.
I mean, at a very low level of football, you know, defenders are told now, you know, when you play a back pass, make sure it's off target. It's a sort of simple thing to do, right? Because then it definitely can't go in. You know, there are just better places that Phil Jones could have kicked that ball. Do you think, Paolo, Manchester United should put all their eggs in the Champions League? I mean, it would blow our minds if they won this competition.
It would, and that's probably why putting all the eggs in that basket isn't the best idea, because I think that they could very easily put all those eggs in that basket and go out in the next round, though they're likely to face a tough draw, having missed this opportunity to win the group. I don't know. They're still such an odd team to me. I mean, I think, again, yet another game where if you sort of just took the, I don't know, the last 20 minutes, half an hour in isolation, you'd think, oh, Man United are playing quite well. It's just everything that happens before the end of games that seems to be going horribly, horribly wrong for them.
Yeah. Lars, do you have any? I mean, it's very hard to know what they are, isn't it?
I'm a complete broken record on this, and I do apologise, but after 2.5 years of Mourinho being there, like, can you tell me one thing they're good at collectively? Like, do they defend well when they sit deep? Do they defend set pieces well? Do they counter-attack well? Do they keep the ball well? Do they have nice build-up play? Is there anything this team is very good at?
This is the interesting conversation. Last year I would have said, yeah, they defend well. Last year they were very good at killing games. They were very good when they wanted to at just taking all the heat out of a game and getting something from it, even if not always 3 points from it. This year, they're not good at that either.
But you say that, but then last year I would have agreed with you, but it feels now, when you look at the numbers from last year and you realise how much of that was actually just David De Gea being amazing, and now that David De Gea is playing more like a regular goalkeeper, they're not able to keep those clean sheets anymore. Mourinho has legitimate and genuine gripes about the recruitment work that's done at that club. That seems to be a bit of a mess. He's not getting the tools he wants. That's fine. I can have some sympathy with that. But he's been there for so long, the team has no identity at all. Like, I mean, what are they good at? Like, they have some really good individual players who can produce moments of quality on the pitch, but, like, what is this team good at?
Only 5 teams in the Premier League conceded more this season. I mean, I just wonder, genuinely, if they said, look, we are, what, 7th in the Premier League, they're not going to win the Premier League, right? There's no chance of that. Actually, they're not going to get in the top 4 because they would need 3 of those teams to have a terrible second half of the season. So you could put an argument forward for Manchester United to say, look, if they win the FA Cup, okay, they get into the Europa League, but they win a trophy, that's good. If they win the Champions League, which is almost impossible, but it's still a trophy, why not play all their kids, play all their youth team players in the Premier League, literally give up completely on the Premier League. to give those players some experience, right? Because you need that, you need game time, so that next year they might have a chance. They don't really want to be in the Europa League. Well, that's not going to be good for them. They'd be better off finishing 10th, giving loads of experience to young kids. The fans would like seeing kids.
Would they, though, if they lose a lot of games?
I don't know.
I think Mourinho would enjoy it if he takes some of these bigger names that he clearly doesn't like very much and just put them on the bench for all to see every game with a bunch of kids on the pitch. I think there's a side to Mourinho who would probably enjoy that.
I feel like Mourinho would like it better if instead of a bench, it was more like a glass viewing gallery, yeah, where he could just sort of have Paul Pogba sort of stood up there in front of everyone, sort of,
and
just making it really clear that I'm not happy with this.
And the stewards hand out rotten fruit to the people in the crowd so they can throw at them.
But Max, this Manchester United team isn't anywhere near good enough to win the Champions League.
No.
You know, all the second place teams are going to want Porto in the next round. I would imagine any of the first place teams would be absolutely delighted to get Manchester United. They're eminently beatable, and their good performances have become the exception rather than the norm. The norm is plodding pedestrian football with no obvious coherent plan, and you know they played very well for the last 10 minutes last night, but the first 80 it was awful. Like,
Malk says, if Mourinho and Theresa May swap jobs, who would do best in their new role?
I'd say Mourinho would do better as leader of the Tory party.
I disagree. I think if you just take Mourinho out of that club, I'm sure there'd be quite a few players who would just immediately feel better about life.
You think Theresa May could get a tune out of Pogba?
It's easier to ignore her anyway.
Young Boys 2, Juve 1. First ever Young Boys win in the Champions League.
Yeah. And a shout out to Guillaume Huaro, who I sort of kind of remember as a bang average centre forward for Paris Saint-Germain back when they were pretty irrelevant because they didn't have all the money, who's turned into this sort of goal machine in the Swiss league where he's got 100 in 150 games. He scored his goal number 100 for Young Boys against Juventus in the Champions League at the age of 34. It's pretty cool. Good on you, Guillaume Huaro.
Well done. And Paulo Dybala, Paulo, scored one amazing goal and scored an even better goal that was disallowed. I'm almost identical.
Yeah.
He can just kick the ball really well.
Yeah. Cristiano Ronaldo taking that one off, maybe unhappy about his thunder being. So, you know, little note, not a thing to get over worried about when you've won the group, but Ronaldo hasn't actually played great in the Champions League for Juventus this season. He's doing fine in the league. Well, he's doing more than fine in the league. He's already double figures, but he's only scored once in five Champions League appearances. Obviously, got sent off very early away to Valencia, but yeah, he hasn't quite, for his tournament, you know, the one which he cares the most about, he hasn't quite sparked in it yet.
One day it'll be the Cristiano Ronaldo trophy. Group H, Ajax Bayern was a brilliant game. 3-3, it had absolutely everything.
I only saw highlights, but it looked fantastic. I mean, I was sort of half tempted to watch it actually, just to see if this Frankie de Jong actually exists or if he's just a media construct. Yeah, it looked remarkable. I wish I had watched it, but the highlight for me, Clive, has to be the Thomas Muller
sending off. I mean, it was like Street Fighter 2, like I said in the intro. It was Hadouken. Yeah, that was it. Like a spinning, like, you know, you press all the buttons at the same time, and you manage to pull off that special move.
He must have just not seen him there. Like, I mean, he was actually trying to kill him. There was some sort of homicidal moment.
No, I don't think it was intentional. He did seem very apologetic in the immediate aftermath.
I'll kick you in the head there, fella. Sorry about that.
Sorry, I can't remember the name of the guy who was on the receiving end, but he apparently had to get staples in the back of his head because it was quite a serious laceration.
Clearly it's medically sound. It just sounds terrible, isn't it? Just after you've had a head injury, then someone takes a stapler to the back of your head as well. Nice to see Dusan Tadic. Yeah. You know, cause we don't see him a lot. He played quite well. Anana in the Ajax goal made a couple of amazing saves from Lewandowski, who is now the top scorer outright in the group stages. 8. Great game, 3-3. Much better than Benfica 1, AEK Athens 0, where virtually nothing happened. So Bayern win the group, Ajax are through, Benfica into the Europa League. Group G, Real Madrid 0, Cesca 3. Which just seems bizarre, Paolo, that could possibly happen. That Real had a couple of chances, and then Cesca just scored 3 goals.
Yeah, well, I was sort of noting the statistical anomaly of Hoffenheim scoring 11 goals and not winning a game. Cesca have won 2 games, both against Real Madrid, and still finished bottom of their group. I mean, it's an odd year.
That's disappointing.
It's an odd year, all right. Again, there was a lot of high-profile games going on. It was hard to sort of watch everything properly, so I can't say I watched 90 minutes of this game, but even in this odd year for Real Madrid, where they have had a few calamitous and shocking results, it's still pretty special to lose 3-0 at home to Cesca, who had beaten no one else in that group.
How safe or unsafe is the manager's job at the Bernabeu?
Well, everyone's expecting them to make a play for Pochettino at the end of the season. So to an extent, given he's already sort of been appointed, but he's no longer officially the interim because of these Spanish rules that meant you have to make him a permanent appointment after a certain time. There's a sort of expectation, at least, that they're going to look at something else in the summer anyway. Whether or not it's so bad that they have to make a move before the summer, I don't know. I think it's probably something they're going to try and avoid. But yeah, yes, I don't know. Getting hammered 3-0 at home in any context, even when you've already won the group, is not a good look for a team of Madrid's stature.
Pilsen beat Roma 2-1 in Group A. Dortmund win the group. Atletico Madrid also through. Bruges into the Europa League. Monaco with just 1 point from their 6 games. 2-0 win for Dortmund in Monaco. Thierry Henry's 6th defeat in 10. How safe is his job, Lars?
I think they have bigger problems at that club, really, than him. I think sacking him now would be very strange. They're in the situation where they've sold their big guns. They've maybe not replaced them as successfully as they would have hoped. He's got a lot of injuries. He has to play a lot of youth team players. And it sounds bizarre, but the Champions League is almost like a distraction they really don't need. They need to get their stuff right in the league. And You can make a case that appointing him in the first place is strange, given the problems that the club have. Is really a guy who's never been a manager before the thing you want at charge of the club, but they made that decision, and sacking him now would be very weird.
Dortmund's win was enough to win the group because Atletico drew 0-0 in Bruges. They were through anyway.
Did you see Thierry Henry at the press conference before the game?
Oh yes, it was great.
Yes, I love that. He was there with one of his young players, and the player got up at the end of the conference and just walked off without pushing his chair back under the table, and Thierry Henry sort of went, "Oi." And then your man very sheepishly walked back and pushed his chair in and went off again. It reminded me of something like my mum would do.
I did think, though, that really he should have told him to take his energy drink with him as well. That was when I was thinking, if you're going to go full pedantry on the chair, then clear up after yourself as well.
Well, the thing is, the energy drink is already there. Okay. He didn't bring it with him.
Okay. No, fair point.
And you say this, who, at the end of every single podcast, cleans the studio in here? Is it you, Max?
Would you like another medal?
Yeah.
You're such a hero, Barry, aren't you?
If it wasn't
so selfless.
If it wasn't for me,
yeah.
This place, we wouldn't be able to move, open the door for Nando's bags, empty coffee cups, empty mugs.
It's all your selection of hats you could possibly wear, isn't it, Barry? Group D, Porto win it, Schalke through in the group of life, Galatasaray into the Europa League. Porto won 3-2 at Galatasaray, Schalke 1-0 over Lokomotiv Moscow. I mean, really, as you were saying, Porto is the winning group that, you know, is the team that everyone who's finished second wants, isn't it? Would you agree
also
with that?
Also, because it's a lovely place to go if you're a fan. Really? It's so nice if you... In terms of underrated European city breaks, it's got to be way the hell up there.
Yeah,
if
you're looking for a mini break, I would thoroughly recommend Porto. There was a Monday night football a long time ago, if you remember it. Everton 2, Watford 2. Obviously, I was very upset about Watford playing in green. But quite a fun game. Everton went one up to Theo Walcott not interfering with play, even though he touched the ball in the move, which is actually quite impressive. And Watford came out absolutely flying in the second half. Seamus Coleman scored a funny own goal, one for Decore. Sigurdsson missed a penalty. Deeney got a lovely free kick at the end. Troy Deeney at the end had a pop at the referees. Kevin Friend. The refs have got a tough job. We as players just want a bit of respect when we're talking. When they make a mistake, we didn't highlight it. We just tried to have a chat with him, but he fobbed us off. We felt like the whole world was against us. So I hope Troy is okay.
Well, that's the nature of football, isn't it? Everyone thinks the whole world is against them.
It's the nature of
generally,
society.
The whole world is completely apathetic.
Mm. I haven't heard of any significant anti-Watford conspiracy. Yeah,
it's Watford,
maybe.
You know. I have more important things to worry about, as I'm sure Kevin Friend has.
What do you think Kevin Friend is mainly worrying about?
I don't know. The carburetor in his
car? Do you reckon?
Car?
Maybe when he got to the Premier League, he bought a really big house, so he's got to keep getting good points from the PGMOL or whatever it is. If he goes down to the Championship, will he fall flat on his mortgage payments?
I don't know, Kevin.
I don't know either.
Kevin, if you're listening,
yeah, let us know.
Tell us what keeps you awake at night. Is it Troy Deeney?
If it does...
That sounds terrible, Barry.
But if it all goes wrong for Kevin Friend, he could just do what Bobby Madley did and move to Norway. He seems to be having a very nice time there. Can I follow him on Twitter? Because he's kind of exploring Norwegian foods and culture. It's good value.
Is he reffing over there?
Not yet, I don't think, but I think he will. I'm following more like him trying out various Norwegian foodstuffs and this sort of weird traditions that he's trying to come to grips with. It's actually good fun. If you follow him on social media, it's good value.
Good idea. Apparently he just reffed his first game, Barry, in front of 12 supporters.
Okay.
Were they 12 Bobby Madley supporters? that swell the gate. 9 supporters. Oh, dear. Anyway, it's a great idea. Why not? A travel show. I'd watch Bobby Madley's travel show Kevin Friend.
But he is now going on his first trip across the border to Sweden. He's going to a sort of cabin, but he's also doing what we refer to as going on a Harry-tour, which is hard to translate, but it's kind of going across to Sweden to buy cheap alcohol.
Oh, excellent.
That doesn't sound hard to translate. That sounds quite, yeah.
Yeah, except you do it in a car. So.
Okay.
Yeah, but you do booze cruises in a car as well.
This is the only end of part two. This is not the end of part three. Right, in part three, we'll start with a belated review, the MLS Cup final. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. We said on Monday we'd cover the final of the MLS, Atlanta 2, Liam Ridgewell's Portland Timbers 0. Let's talk to CNN sports anchor Kate Riley, who has woken up at 4 in the morning to talk to us. So less of your moaning about being here at 8 in the morning, everyone. Kate, how are you doing?
Yeah, doing well, thank you, all things considered.
Thanks so much for waking up at this ridiculous hour for us. We appreciate it. Atlanta, I was going to ask a sort of, patronising question about whether you could move for supporters in Atlanta. That's where you're based. But you were telling me this week that you can't get a ticket for games. It's that popular now.
Yeah, seriously, it's the hottest ticket in town. And when I moved to Atlanta, some 3.5 years ago, there was lots of grumblings and doubts around the city that, this place wouldn't be a soccer city and that won't be a success and this place is all about collegiate football and that won't break through. But essentially now we are a city of transplants, 7 million people and growing. People come here with, I guess, their college affiliation and their NFL affiliation, but the president of the club, Daniels, told a news outlet yesterday that no one comes here with a soccer affiliation unless you're a British expat, and so therefore they'll be able to capitalise on that and starting from scratch. And like we saw at the MLS final on Saturday night, a record number of people were watching that final, 73,000 in the stadium. The club averages about 55,000 throughout the season, which is a record as well. And if you crunch the stats, they've had over 1 million people through the turnstiles this season. So, I mean, they do well. They market it very well. You've arguably got soccer, football in the best stadium in America, if not the world, the Mercedes-Benz Stadium. They keep the prices down, so it's like hot dogs for $2, beer for a fiver, tickets are $33, so you call up £20. You can feed your family of four for like under $30. So, I mean, yeah, they do very well. They've capitalized on, I guess, Atlanta's rap and hip-hop culture as well, so they've made the soccer cool here. So they've been able to integrate with that culture. Ludacris, of course, lives in Atlanta, and say 3 years ago helped launch the team. Waka Flocka, they've linked up with him. He's a brand ambassador. He's got a box in Mercedes-Benz Stadium. In fact, we were in his box on Saturday night, and someone senior at MLS told me that my mom was actually sitting in a seat. So there you go.
Kate, you've mentioned several young people's musicians there, and we're all sitting here looking blankly at each other, but we'll take your word for it.
Well, yeah, there's always Google, but yeah, that had to help me put it that way.
Did they deserve to win the game?
Very much so, yeah. It was a great game. Like, the atmosphere was amazing, for one, bearing in mind we had freezing rain in Atlanta on Saturday night, but you're not going to argue with having like the league's MVP scoring the opening goal of the game, the most decorated single season player in Josef Martinez. Of course, many of your listeners will know him from his Torino days, and perhaps the Venezuelans didn't really have like the best of reputations when he joined Atlanta. I mean, you see, like, he scored, 7 goals and 58 appearances before he came to stateside. You compare that now to like his 45 goals and 51 appearances for Atlanta, holds the record for number of goals in a single season, 31 in 2018. So, yeah, when Josef Martinez opened the scoring for Atlanta United, I mean, if you didn't need 73,000 going crazy, you certainly got it after his opening goal. Bragi Zahn, of course, a regular in the Premier League, Aston Villa, and of course Middlesbrough most recently. He's the goalkeeper for Atlanta. He had a great save in the second half, so it's not as though it was all the home side. Yeah, of course, you mentioned Liam Ridgewell there. He did have a good game, but unfortunately Atlanta were just like too dominant at home. Yeah, it was just like a festival of noise and colour. And Atlanta, they have like this great tradition of, even though they've only been going for 2 years, but they have a great tradition. They've got some really creative people creating tifos at the start of every game. And just they've got a band there and chants that go on for 90 minutes. And yeah, it's very difficult for teams as good as Portland, who were very deserving of being in the MLS Cup final, to come to Atlanta and come away with the result.
Come away from the final for a second. This Zach Steffen, who's coming from Columbus Crew to join Man City, and I know there's been quite a buzz about this. He's a US national team goalkeeper. Obviously, it's going to be tough to get games with Edison, I would have thought, already at Man City. But could you give us an idea of Steffen and whether people should be excited about him coming to City?
Yeah, very much so. So I had the fortune of interviewing him when they were doing the media rounds at the MLS All-Star earlier this year. I cannot praise that young man enough. He is engaging off the field and very articulate. And I think we benefit here in the States from youngsters going to college and then ending up being professional athletes. I feel like you've got someone who, like I said, is very engaging to talk with, knows the game inside out, and it's such a loss for the MLS that he's going to the Premier League. But yeah, well done him, and it's just really exciting to see the English Premier League looking at youngsters in the States again. And of course, you've got a great pedigree of American Premier League goalkeepers. Friedel in his day, Brad Guzan, I just mentioned, he's now at Atlanta. Tim Howard, of course. So no doubt he is getting the baton, he'll just be such a success over in the States if and when he gets the chance. But of course, the USA players are hungry, right? After the embarrassment of not qualifying for the Russian World Cup, so this guy's got a lot to prove, and he will be very much dedicated to the cause.
Kate, thank you so much for coming on at this ridiculous time of day. We appreciate it.
Thank you, mate.
Cheers. Kate Riley there from CNN. Lars, yes?
I was just saying, I've watched quite a lot of Atlanta this season because I'm up very late for no obvious reason, and they play like really fun, infectious football in addition to becoming this extraordinary phenomenon in the city. And hopefully they can continue doing this because their manager is leaving. Tata Martino is leaving, presumably, to take over at the Mexican national team. That's what people are saying. And we'll see who replaces him. And hopefully they'll be fun again next season. They're a really, really great team.
Just to educate you, Barry, Waka Flocka Flame is better known as born Joaquim James Malford, an American rapper, signing to the 1017 Brick Squad. In 2009, became a mainstream artist with his release of his singles Oh Let's Do It, Hard in Da Paint, and No Hands.
Is that Hands with a Z?
No, Hands is spelt as you would spell Hands.
Oh, okay.
Hard in Da Paint.
I think he missed a trick there.
Do you think so? Well, you know, you could be the consultant for Waka Flocka Flame. Get your people to talk to his people. We'll see what happens. In the Europa League tonight, Chelsea are through as group winners. They've got a free swing away at Vidi in Hungary. Same with Arsenal at home to Karabag. Celtic need to avoid defeat against group winners RB Salzburg to qualify. A defeat coupled with an RB Leipzig win would see Celtic drop into third. Rangers are in third, but first and second in the group are both just a point ahead of them. They need to win to qualify. Anything else will see them go out. CX says it'd be great to see a mention of the Lee Griffiths situation, Bass.
Well, yeah, Lee Griffiths he's had a weird season. He's been absent for long periods. No one was quite sure why. There was rumours doing the rounds, and it's now been officially announced by Celtic that he's going to take an unspecified amount of time out of the game to get treatment for personal problems, which are understood to be a severe gambling addiction and possibly other personal issues which aren't really for public consumption. But I sort of wish him all the best. He's quite a divisive character in Scotland, but gambling is a scourge, and my heart would go out to anyone who's suffering from an addiction like that, because I know people who have been affected by it and their lives have been pretty much destroyed. Yeah. Oh, well, look, echo those thoughts, and we wish him all the best. The Premier League games, Liverpool-Manchester United on Sunday. That's the big one, Lars.
It is.
Who's going to win it?
Liverpool, I
yes.
think. Yes.
I'm not so sure. And I'm not so sure it's going to be a very good game. The last two games between those sides at Anfield have ended scoreless. Manchester United will rock up, they'll park the bus, and I think the only way we'll get a good game out of this is if Liverpool score one, if not two, early goals.
Elsewhere, it's one of those fixture lists that doesn't fly off the page, doesn't necessarily mean it won't be the best weekend of football. Man City, Everton's the early kickoff. Huddersfield, Newcastle, Spurs, Burnley. Watford play Cardiff. Wolves play Bournemouth. Musings from Molyneux says, with Bournemouth having lost just as many games as they've won now, are we all going to get off the Eddie Howe bus and realise he'll never have it as good as he does down there? One job away from AFCB and one failure. So he's really setting himself up if Wolves don't beat Bournemouth there. Does anybody want to get off the Eddie Howe bus? I'm still on it.
Very much on it.
I'll stay on the bus for now, yeah.
I will stay on the bus. I had to do a little preview this for Friday, and I just noticed a bit of a parallel between Burnley last season and Bournemouth this season, but that they both started very well, far better than people expected, then had a slump. Bournemouth have lost five of their last six, and yet they've only dropped two places in the league. Last season, Burnley didn't win a game any game out of 11 either side of Christmas and dropped one place. So, you know, I don't know what it says about life or the state of the Premier League or anything, but I just thought there were quite interesting similarities.
Fulham play West Ham, Brighton, Chelsea, Southampton, Arsenal. There's a tweeted question. I apologise, I've taken your name off the tweet. It says, do you know when the raffle winners are being announced for who's playing centre-back for Arsenal this weekend? They're missing quite a lot, aren't they?
They are. Lauren Koscielny actually is apparently likely to make some sort of appearance against Carabag, so perhaps alleviating the situation. But yes, Arsenal very much running out of defenders at the moment.
Lars, it looks like you're desperate to say something.
Not desperate. I was just going to say, I'm quite looking forward to Fulham West Ham. I mean, West Ham have kind of gotten their stuff together and have won three on the bounce now, I believe. And Ranieri presumably is trying to make Fulham better at some point. And just notice that Fulham are actually, like, for all their woes, Fulham are actually closer to 14th than Man United are to 5th. So, you know, which I guess says more about Man United's situation. But that's what I'm looking for.
You must have been very disappointed to see Burnley winning at the weekend.
I'm not, no.
Jack says, in light of Sunderland's Netflix documentary being released on Friday, which one footballing moment, season, scandal do you wish was documented by an all-access film crew? Barry, you've seen the Sunderland one, haven't you?
Yes, I had to do an article on it, which is on the website at the moment. It's really good. It's terrific. I'd recommend it to anyone. Sunderland fans obviously will probably get more out of it than anyone else, but any football fan will be entertained by it. It's very well made. There's no narrator. It's sort of the people of the city are the narrators. They provide the background. They keep the story ticking over. It is obviously made with a lot of love and affection for the city of Sunderland, because I think some of the makers are from, I think a couple of them were actually in school with Jonathan Wilson. And you go behind the scenes at the club and you've got a team there. I suspect that documentary makers were invited in because Sunderland thought they would be promoted back into the Premier League. And
they weren't.
I think it may have been a bit of an ego vehicle for the now departed chief executive, Martin Bain. And he came across really badly in it. He seemed quite apathetic, bit of an egomaniac, pointing fingers of blame everywhere but at himself for the club's shortcomings. And then, you know, you have a team there, half of them aren't good enough, half of them don't care. There's no money to spend. They're scrabbling around on deadline day trying to get loans in, failing. Their top scorer, Lewis Graben, is a loanee. He leaves in January because he just doesn't like it there. And it's a very interesting insight into how to run a club very, very badly. But the one thing that is a recurrent theme throughout is the optimism of the fans. At the start, they're optimistic that they'll get promoted again. Then things start to go south and they're optimistic that things will pick up. It's just, you know, at times they're angry. There's fury over Jack Rodwell's situation inside and outside the club because he's sitting there on 70 grand a week. The club want him to leave and he just won't. And why should he, to be honest? But he's stealing a living there. He doesn't care. He's not interested in playing. He comes out of it very badly. He had the two drink-related incidents involving Darren Gibson. He was a major contributor to the documentary until... he got sacked by the club. They get through two managers, an owner, a chairman in the course of the season. It's just, it's a car crash. I mean, I'd like to see it again. I had to kind of watch seven episodes in a row in one day, which was a bit...
It's a bit of a binge.
Yeah, a bit too bingy for me. So I, you know, but if you could watch in one or two episodes at a time, I couldn't recommend it more.
You mentioned... the question says, you know, where would you like to see a moment or a season or a scandal documented by an All Access film crew? I wouldn't have minded a documentary on being at school with Jonathan Wilson. It would be fascinating to see. It would have been great if there'd been a documentary crew in the dressing room after in Mexico 86 after the Maradona handball.
Yeah.
Just to see, you know, the rage of Terry Butcher, you know, and the rest, I think. I don't know.
Well, actually, funny you mention that, because there's been a documentary made about Sunderland before when Premier Passions, mm-hmm. when Peter Reid was in charge, and that was also fantastic, and they got relegated that season as well. But that one was famous for Reedy's dressing room rants and, you know, foul-mouthed outbursts against his players. There's none of that in this. You don't get the dressing room remains a sanctuary, at least on match day, but it's no poorer for that. It's
intriguing that there are not one but two behind the scenes documentaries of Sunderland getting relegated. Could this become
happens a lot.
Could this just become a whole genre?
Yeah, well when you go to action films, Western, Will Smith films,
westerns, comedies, Sunderland getting relegated.
Yeah, you would have a lot to choose from.
New to buy, new to rent. JH says,
it's just fascinating questions that you think of moments you'd like to have seen. And obviously, I think probably I'd be even more interested by the Milan than the Liverpool dressing room of the 3-3 final to see sort of the halftime and then the afterwards. Likewise, Italy against South Korea, the World Cup defeat, see how that was going down. Although, honestly, the first thought that came into my mind when I heard that question was Mourinho back in 2007 hiding in a laundry basket. I just think that could be great sort of Partridge-esque documentary television.
That's brilliant. Jay, on Feedback Corner, JH says, upon moving to Sheffield, I've discovered this is Yorkshire puddings and Christmas dinner. That not only do you have Yorkshire pudding with Christmas dinner, it has its own separate course before the main meal. They bring out starters of just a Yorkshire pudding. I mean, it's ridiculous. You've got to have gravy with it.
But does that not... You'd just be stuffed after that, wouldn't you?
Rich says on the Robert Snodgrass, I'm sure I'm not the first to mention, but if poor old Robert Snodgrass was snacking at Scotch Corner while commuting between Essex and Villa, he probably needs a new sat-nav. And Flexington says, I'm not sure why Barry gets all the stick for being the show's humbug. Every time you guys are having fun going off topic, producer Jonathan stops it. For Christmas, just let Barry go off topic and discuss what he wants until he's finished. Hashtag not my producer. And on that note, Flatback 4 says, my dad is traditionally hard to buy for. What Christmas present would you suggest for a 60-something male who likes horse racing, golf, and classic Irish ballads?
Oh, well, golfers are easy to buy for, aren't they? I mean, I always struggle to buy to know what to get my dad, because he doesn't really have a huge number of interests. He just reads a lot, but any book I get him, he's either read it already or he doesn't like it.
And does he say, I've read it straight as soon as he opens it? I imagine he's an exaggerated version of you.
I'm a ray of sunshine, by comparison.
Poor old Mother Glendening on Christmas. You are going home to see them this Christmas, aren't you?
I am, yes.
Oh, what a good son you are. Hey, Lars.
Hi. I was just going to say, last Christmas I put up like a photo on Twitter of what we were eating, and there was a Yorkshire pudding there. And I got a surprisingly angry tweet from Jonathan Wilson about how this was a complete shambles. I wasn't aware this was such a contentious issue.
No, it's not with turkey.
There's a pal of mine from York, and his dad, after the Christmas dinner or regularly around Christmas time, has a glass of whiskey, but he eats Christmas cake and cheese at the same time.
Sort of sounds quite like the Middle Ages, doesn't it? Look at Jonathan's face. Actually, I've got to go to work. Paolo, thanks for your time.
Cheers.
Cheers, Lars.
Bye, Max.
Cheers, Barry.
Bye.
Back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.